anger has not been an embraced emotion for many, many eons. But perhaps right now, in this unprecedented time in our country's history, the appropriate emotion is anger.
Bryan Cranston wins a Tony for playing a TV news anchor in Network. Today on The Frame Weekend, he makes his case for getting mad as hell. And John DeLorean invented a famous car, dated supermodels, and was busted by the FBI. The complicated history of making a movie about a complicated man.
His children saw him as, you know, one man, his wife as another, his business associates another man. You know, he was neither hero and villain.
Then childhood friends make a love letter to their hometown in the movie The Last Black Man in San Francisco. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Stick around. I'm John Horn, and welcome to The Frame Weekend. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and how their art intersects with the issues of the wider world. Later on the show, Eleni Mandel teaches songwriting in a women's prison, then makes an album that is inspired by what she learned from the inmates. And a top film critic says what movies need is more sex. Yes, she does. But first, Bryan Cranston wins a Tony Award for playing this guy.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs right now, go to the window, open it, stick out your heads and yell. And I want you to yell. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Cranston plays Howard Beale in the stage adaptation of the movie Network. It was made in 1976, written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. It was supposed to be kind of a broad satire, but more than 40 years later, it was oddly prescient about our addiction to media. At one point in the play, Cranston urges the entire audience to share his character's rage.
The most important thing that any storyteller, whether you're on stage or film or television, is to elicit an emotional response. If I don't move them to some emotion, I feel like I've failed. So in this case, Patty and our production team for the theatrical version of it has created an instigation to be able to light a fire under people. And actually, when we get them to say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, it's giving them permission to be angry as a legitimate emotion. And I think our society has been lacking in that. We can accept someone who is irritated or sad or despondent, but anger has not been an embraced emotion for many, many eons. We see someone who's angry, we get away from that person. And usually, as a human being, it's appropriate to be tolerant and accepting and embracing of all different beliefs and opinions and religions and lifestyles. It is a lovely thing to do as a human being to be more open. But perhaps right now, in this unprecedented time in our country's history, perhaps now the appropriate emotion is anger, because anger does stimulate activity. I remember in the 60s when anger stimulated a whole movement of anti-war protests and songs and art and plays and movies, and it was a movement that really moved the needle.
First, you've got to get mad. And when you're mad enough, then we'll figure out what to do. Stick out your heads and yell, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm mad as hell.
One of the other things that I think this play is about paying attention and keeping your eyes open and listening to what people are saying. And I was struck by something I saw when I saw you in the play a couple of months ago. There's a moment where your character goes into the audience a couple rows deep and you're interacting with the audience. And there was a man, and I'm just ballparking his age, he's about 65 years old, and he takes out his cell phone to shoot a selfie. And I was like, You're in the middle of live theater. This is a story about paying attention and listening to what's being said, and your instinct is to document it on your iPhone and not be present in the moment. And I suspect that didn't happen just that one night. What do you see when you go in the audience, and what does it reinforce in your mind about what the play is really addressing?
Well, I think it's very astute, because that is exactly what Patty was railing against, is that we were so addicted to the tube back then, this console, this magnet in the household that drew all of our attention. We were absolutely addicted to it. Now it's far worse, because that tube is now a television that you can hold in your hand. And it's not just a television. It's your schedule maker. It's your typewriter. It's your radio. It's your camera. It's all these things. It's an amazing tool. But we have to remember that it is just a tool. And if you don't control your use of the tool, it could be misused. And then all of a sudden the tool is using you.
That was Bryan Cranston. He just won the Tony Award for playing Howard Beale in the stage adaptation of Network. This is The Frame Weekend. Network, unfortunately, just closed, but there's another very provocative play that just opened here in Los Angeles. It's called Dana H., and it was written by Lucas Nath, who is one of the more interesting playwrights in American theater right now. When Lucas Nath was in college, his mom, who'd been a hospice worker, was essentially kidnapped by a man that she'd cared for. He was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. He insinuated himself in her life, and he took her on the road, and she couldn't figure out a way to escape him. She had some issues from her own past that made it hard for her to choose how to get away. Lucas Nath wanted to tell her story. His mom actually wanted the story told as well, and he couldn't figure out how to tell it. And then he had this idea.
The play would be composed of interviews that fellow theater maker Steve Cawson conducted with my mother.
Lucas mentioned to me that you're a chaplain in a hospice.
Mm-hmm. About 20 years now I've been doing that.
And that I would take those recordings and build the recordings into the play so that it would be lip-synced.
Yeah, one day I was trying to figure out how many times I've been present at the point of death, at the very moment of death, and it averages about 3 to 4 times a week for 20 years, so multiply that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think it was many years until I had the idea, and it was always something that was in the back of my head, to use lip-syncing and to use the form of monologue based on actual interviews. But I think she was more ready for it than I was. And for me, it was just a matter of just constantly checking with her and saying, okay, is this okay to be in the play? Is this okay to be in the play? And always saying, look, if at any point you change your mind, we can take stuff out, we can remove things. Anything that we removed really had more to do with what was essential to telling the story that we were telling, what got us to the end of the play.
He didn't really know how to do much of anything, and he latched on to me as his security. I get the picture of like a child hanging on to their teddy bear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how it was.
I've, for many, many, many years, been very fond of lip-syncing. I love virtuosic acts.
How does that change the experience for the audience? I know how I reacted to it, but I'm curious what your thinking was, and maybe even what you observed as you're working on the show and seeing your actor perform it and watching the audience listen to her mouth the words that were being spoken in previously recorded audio.
Well, there's definitely a strangeness to it. I mean, it's a little bit of a seance. We're conjuring the spirit in the room. It's an act of channeling. And for whatever reason, that seemed intuitively right for the play. You know, it's strange at first. It may even be kind of funny, just because it's uncanny to see somebody speaking and see that illusion be so tight. And then you start to forget about it until there's a moment that I'm very keen on where the actress Dee Dee, in the course of lip syncing, just takes out a bottle of water and drinks some water and then goes back to talking. There's something strange about the natural, real act of drinking water out of a bottle and lip syncing with a fake voice. And I don't know why it's strange, but I just find it kind of magical.
He demonstrated how a guy hit him, and that's when he hit me. And I fell over backwards. I was unconscious. I remember coming in and out a little bit. I remember him calling my name. I remember him being very frantic. I remember him saying that he was so, so sorry. He kept saying that over and over. I remember him saying, but I can't take you to a hospital around here. I don't know what we're going to do. I'd have to take you somewhere else.
The other thing that I found magical in watching it is the few moments of silence when, although the audience is listening to and your actress, Dee Dee O'Connell, is lip-syncing every line, there are a couple of moments when you're not hearing anything. And it, to my mind, really changes the way you listen not only to what she's saying, but also to silence and what silence means in the course of the story.
Yeah, that was another thing that was really important to me, was to find these moments of just heavy silence. And we played around a lot with how long some of those silences would be. But when we started, if I have one superpower as a playwright, it's that I'm a terrible audience member.
What does that
and
mean?
I get bored very easily. I get confused very easily. Other people's plays and my own equally. And when we started the rehearsal process, we had the audio track assembled. And first thing I said is, I can't follow that at all. And so I started rearranging pieces. And one of the key elements was to add in even more silence, because we just sort of need moments to digest this barrage of information, which she delivers very quickly.
We're talking with playwright Lucas Naith. His play Dana H. is at the Kirk Douglas Theater, while another, Hillary and Clinton, is on Broadway.
I sure as hell am not nostalgic for those moments, like the moment when everybody found out that you were sleeping around, that moment when your inability to get certain things under control nearly cost you the entire race, when it fell on me to go out there and tell everybody what a good guy you were, what a good husband you were, how you were such a trustworthy fella.
I was thinking about other things that you have written, Doll's House Part 2, The Christians, Hillary and Clinton. And I was thinking about this idea that we live in an era of judgment. And it can be, you know, something as banal as a like on an Instagram post, or it can be trying to say, well, that person shouldn't have done this, I would have done that. And I was thinking about those plays. And one of the things that I take away from them is that even as we're inclined to judge the actions of lead characters in your plays, ultimately, I think we come to understand why they made decisions that might not have been our own.
No, that's probably my mission statement. I think about that. That is something that I do think about very consciously a lot. And I'll often build plays to even lead the audience a little bit down the path of judging and making assumptions, and then the story always wants to have a moment where I, for lack of a better term, indict the audience. I catch them in the act, and I try to make them conscious of certain assumptions they're making or certain paths their minds are going down.
Lucas, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lucas Naith. His new play is called Dana H. It's up now at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. Coming up, John DeLorean's car was made famous by a movie. His life was made infamous by an FBI surveillance video. A new documentary looks at this very complicated man. Next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Not that long ago, the major Hollywood studios made something called adult dramas. They were not superhero movies. They were not Harry Potter. They were not based on some theme park idea. They were dramas for grown-ups. And a lot of those movies had pretty good sex scenes in them. But those movies have gone away, and as they've gone away, so too has sex in a lot of Hollywood mainstream movies. Ann Hornaday is the lead film critic at the Washington Post, and she says, let's bring some sex back.
I came of age in the 70s and 80s when I just feel that there was this certain kind of sex scene in movies that maybe they didn't push the envelope, you know, in terms of formalism or even necessarily content, but the way that they were staged and choreographed and executed were really genuinely fun to watch and kind of, you know, once in a while they would quote unquote turn you on, and it was just part of the pleasure of seeing the movie. It wasn't necessarily thought to be, you know, particularly subversive or transgressive. It was just a part of movie grammar. And I just feel like that element of kind of mainstream sex scene, you know, has just been lost. It's either now the purview of these edgy art house auteurs who are trying to push it as far as it could go, or it's just very, very quickly glossed over.
The thing that I remember from the 80s and 90s is that some of those scenes that I think we're talking about, movies like Body Heat, An Officer and a Gentleman, they were provocative, but they weren't explicit.
Exactly. It really, you're exactly right. They weren't, because as a matter of fact, it's interesting. I had occasion to rewatch Officer and a Gentleman recently.
There's still no excuse. You're not going out getting what you want. Just go get it.
And who says I'm not going after what I want?
It was really about the chemistry between the actors, which apparently there really wasn't any chemistry between Deborah Winger and Richard Gere. They really weren't getting along that well, and maybe that's why it worked so well, but it was just such a sweet scene.
It feels like one of the things that might be driving this is that the big studios are focused on what they call a four-quadrant film, a film that will play
exactly to
men and women, old and young. Those are the four quadrants.
Right.
And they don't want to offend anybody, and so they
that's
take
right.
this kind of prudish take on sex. At the same time, they take what I would consider as a parent to be a very aggressive stance on violence.
I think that's a very good point. And one email I got did point up the ratings board and the hypocrisy with the rating system and going after sex where they really let all manner of violence get a PG-13 rating and then they get really freaked out around sexual expression. I do think that's a hypocrisy. But like to your point about the four quadrant, that's why we have these superhero movies, which are the most sexless movies on the, you know, in the world. And now, you know, it's very oriented toward the international market. And so I think that's also going to be a factor in their decision making about what can they export and being sensitive to cultural sensibilities. But on the other hand, this awards movie, you know, these Oscar movies, as long as studios still want to be in that game, there's that little sliver of hope that this can still find a way, you know, within studio movies.
Ann Hornaday is the chief film critic at The Washington Post, and she wants more sex in movies. I hope you get your wish.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe that.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The Kansas City-based Latin rock band Making Movies wasn't very well known. And then singer Ruben Blades invited them to record a song with him. Now Making Movies is touring the country. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos got a chance to talk with the band during its stop in Los Angeles.
It's a late Wednesday afternoon at the Moroccan Lounge, a small club a few blocks from Little Tokyo. The band Making Movies is doing its sound check and rehearsing one of the tunes it will play with trumpeter and singer Asdru Sierra of the LA band Ozomatli. After the sound check, I sat down with the band members backstage. They told me Making Movies started 10 years ago in Kansas City, guitarist and lead singer Enrique Chi.
I met Juan Carlos and Andres' mother, who has a ballet folklorico, and she came up to me because I was playing like some acoustic music at that time, and she's like, you should meet my sons. They're musicians and they're very talented.
She started the group 40 years ago in the west side of Kansas City, where a lot of the Mexican immigrants went to.
That's percussionist and keyboard player Juan Carlos Chaurand.
That's where they first got, because there was a lot of work there for meatpacking and the railroads. And so they built a community there in that area.
Chaurand's younger brother Andres plays drums in the band. Juan Carlos says their mother's folklorico troupe was their anchor.
We just grew up loving it and being around it all the time. And so that's definitely helped us maintain our culture and our raíces as Mexicanos, even though we grew up in Kansas City in the middle of the United States.
Enrique Chi says the concept behind ballet folklorico, using the art form as a way for immigrant children to retain their identity, helped them create a foundation for the band.
Her work became a bit of the blueprint for the Making Movies mission, even though it's a completely different vehicle, but to accomplish the same thing. So we started playing rock and roll music, but using folkloric rhythm from Latin America as the foundation.
A few years ago, the quartet traveled together to Panama to explore the traditional music scene. That's where the Chi family is from. Enrique's younger brother, bassist Diego Chi, says the Chaurán brothers noticed the similarities between Panama's traditional mejorana and son jarocho from Veracruz, Mexico.
So that showed us, even then, that the lesson of how interconnected we all are, that even though you would think that these cultures are so different, that there was already a thread that was connecting them, even if that thread was just a rhythmic pulse.
This is Making Movies' third album. Diego Chi says the concept behind it began to take shape when they learned that fellow Panamanian Ruben Blades was interested in collaborating with them.
Came as a great surprise a couple years ago at the Latin Grammys. He had apparently listened to our music at some point. He liked it, and he mentioned us on the red carpet. And the next day, he went on social media and said, "I would love to collaborate with Making Movies." Yeah. La tierra no sabe
dónde un país comienza ni dónde termina. In Panama, the Chi brothers grew up listening to Ruben Blades at home. As they began their music career, Blades' political and socially conscious songs were a template they wanted to follow.
For him to call us out was, I mean, not only an honor, but we basically cried and screamed and ordered a round of shots right away. that began a conversation that resulted in No Te Calles, and that song speaks to Latino America, but it speaks to anyone, and it invites people to raise their voices against corruption and injustice.
After they recorded the song, Blades asked if they wanted to put the song on an album.
And well, we thought, well, maestro, if that's okay with you, we would love to make an album based on this idea. And he agreed, and so we set down this path to kind of make an album that faced a lot of the issues that our society seems to be facing right now, to things that we need to speak out about right now. I know that guy, yes.
The songs address social and political issues by telling stories. To that end, Blades also proved helpful to the band. He advised them to think of the album as a book. Making Movies also invited a few musicians from Los Angeles to help them tell some personal stories. Los Lobos saxophonist Steve Berlin co-produced the album. His bandmate, David Hidalgo, played accordion and sang on the classic Corrido by Los Tigres del Norte, De Paisano a Paisano. For the song Tormenta, they invited Las Cafeteras. Osomatli's Asdru Sierra joined them for the song Pedacito de Papel, Little Piece of Paper. The song tells the story of an immigrant family's struggle trying to get a visa in the U.S.
That really hit me, you know. Like, I'm obviously second, third generation Latino. I remember, and right here in L.A., and I remember my parents trying to, the paperwork and the money and the lawyer fees and everything just to get another visa and to get the green card and then to get citizenship. It's always, it's a long and arduous thing. It's a journey and it's painful.
But there was one more surprise from Ruben Blades. He gave the band a demo of a song he wrote in 1987 with Lou Reed during the session for his album Nothing But the Truth. The song never made it to the album. The band was ecstatic.
We're like, oh my God, what? And so we made an arrangement and we played it for him in New York, and he decided to sing a duet with me on the tune. And it's one of my favorite songs on the record because it
it swings a little different than our music normally would, but the lyrics sound as fresh today as they did 30 years ago, and we're just incredibly honored to be the band to get to show the world this Lou Reed and Ruben Blades song from 30 years ago.
Ruben Blades invited them to play with him this November in Mexico City. This will be their first performance in Mexico and their first gig with one of their heroes. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos. For
the love of Delilah. The latest album by Making Movies is called Americana, and it's available now on streaming services. It's The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Hart. Hollywood loves movies about real people, especially if their lives have a lot of highs and a lot of lows. So the life of John DeLorean feels like a perfect Hollywood film. He had movie star good looks, supermodel girlfriends, a lot of money, and he invented an iconic car, the DeLorean, which you probably know was featured in the 1985 movie Back to the Future.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine? Kind of a DeLorean?
The way I see it, if you're going to build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style?
Hollywood tried but never succeeded in making any of about half a dozen planned feature films about DeLorean. Now there's a new documentary about why those movies didn't get made. It's called Framing John DeLorean, directed by Don Argott and Sheena M. Joyce.
John is really hard to crack. He was never super emotional, certainly all of the footage that we've seen. Even in the worst of times, he's unflappable. He's cool.
All right, the involvement with cocaine. Talk about that. Why did it happen? You say it
was
entrapment.
Well, it's a peculiar thing because, you know, in my life, I have never, even to this day, with the exception of that one suitcase they threw in front of me, and I'm not even sure what that was, but I've never ever seen cocaine, touched cocaine, used cocaine, or been in the presence of anybody.
And so we took this concept of these unproduced projects and decided to use that as a device in our film to see if we could, you know, in a sense, crack the code by talking about how no one has cracked the code yet.
We were always looking for a way in to tell the story. And I think once we settled on the idea of using the, kind of failed attempts at making the film, that opened up a whole new kind of creative possibility for us with the idea of using actors and reenactments. And then obviously, in addition to that, we filmed the making of those reenactments to give another layer of insight into John's character.
You draw a straight line up, the brow overlaps the corner of the eye.
Well, I think it's going to come in a little bit.
It's going to come over?
Yeah.
There are three different elements to your documentary. One is the traditional documentary where you have people that you talk to on camera, archival footage, and then you have the reenactments of what happened. And then you go to the other step, which is that you have Alec Baldwin kind of getting into character, actually putting on the makeup to play John DeLorean.
When you start to play him, you go, no. He's not guilty of anything. In fact, it's the opposite. He's a hero in his mind. He's a hero. And you have to play that.
So as you're watching Alec Baldwin put on the makeup with his Saturday Night Live makeup team, what is going through your head as he's transforming himself into John DeLorean?
We were having these great conversations with Alec leading up to filming. He's so smart and thoughtful and would ask such great questions.
We shoot him for your purposes over the arc of how many years?
Mostly early 70s to early 80s.
Right, there's a business spread, and he aged during that time.
Yeah, that's right.
And I want to see how his behavior ages. I need to see clips that are...
We were just talking about how the conversations that were happening off screen were sometimes, you know, just as illuminating as a talking head interview would have been.
People who know John DeLorean know not only about the car, but about the sting. And this is a clip of the day that the FBI and the DEA arrange the deal to entrap, as it turns out, John DeLorean.
And the government picked him up, took him to a hotel room, opened a bottle of champagne, toasted to their success. And one of the agents went to the closet, brought out the suitcase of cocaine and opened it up.
Between this and the other half, it's gonna generate about four and a half mil.
It's better than gold,
Gold weighs more than that, for God's sakes.
That's when DeLorean said, this is like gold. This is better than gold.
Better than gold. Gold weighs more than that, for God's sakes.
Classic line on that tape.
So during this sequence, you have reenacted moments, you have actual surveillance tape, you have commentary. How does that scene work in your minds, and why was it essential to have so many different things going on in just a couple of seconds of the film?
I think for us, it provided a way to weave the straight kind of talking head documentary elements and the narrative elements together in a more creative or seamless way.
They put John in a situation which is basically, you know, a glorified movie set. You know, he's on camera. They're trying to get him to say, be and act a certain way so they can get him on camera so that they could use it against him later.
Undercover agents dressed as other people.
Right. I think it's this kind of pivotal moment. And at that point, you don't know what's real, what's not real. And that was really how we wanted that to come across.
Don Argott and Sheena Joyce are the directors of Framing John DeLorean. Don and Sheena, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Framing John DeLorean is in theaters now. It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Eleni, great to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
It is an honor and a pleasure.
Eleni Mandel is an LA-based singer and songwriter.
Split myself in half, I don't know if it's my future, if it's my past.
And not that long ago, she decided she was going to teach music inside women's prisons. Her new album is informed by those sessions. It is called Wake Up Again.
What I thought about a lot were actions and regrets. How do we be our best selves? And how can we repair the mistakes we've made? And what if we can't? How do we live with ourselves if we can't repair the mistakes we've made? And I also thought a lot about how anybody can make mistakes. You know, some of these inmates, I had a lawyer, a nurse, an elementary school teacher, people who were smart, who had lives and husbands and children, and mistakes were made. And then, of course, economically disadvantaged people as well.
The lyric that I have circled even before you came in here from Wake Up Again is, was it my fate to make those mistakes? If I had the chance, would I, could I wake up again? And you can think of those words being spoken by somebody who was in prison for 30 years. And you can think about somebody who is out working in the real world who didn't do the right thing when somebody was in crisis.
Yeah. And I think, even though the songs were informed by the work I did there, I guess in some ways they're as much about me and my experiences and my fears as they are about them. And I did have one student who I found out was in prison for the death of her grandchild. And I have been angry at my children, and I have said things and been angry in a way I didn't know I was capable of. And I think about her and just that split second where it's too late.
When you see people who are locked up, how would you describe what music means to them and how it might be different from the way music means something to all the other people that you've met in your life before?
I think in some ways their experience of music is like my experience of music growing up, because they don't get to, you know, be on the internet and live stream, and so they're still holding on to songs in this meaningful way that we did in the 70s and 80s and 90s before everything changed. So it feels more important to them, and I love that, and I miss that feeling for myself too.
Eleni, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
If I could rewind, back in time.
Coming up, even as YouTube is trying to police hate speech, its algorithm may actually be penalizing positive LGBTQ-related content. That story is next on The Frame Weekend.
Swim to the tide. Make the noise stop.
Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Every minute, 500 hours of new video are uploaded to YouTube. Some of it is good, some of it is stupid, but some of it is really hateful. And YouTube is trying to figure out a way to police that. Ina Fried is the chief technology correspondent at Axios, and she was at a coding conference earlier this week where she challenged YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki about racist and homophobic attacks on YouTube aimed at a journalist from Vox.com. But Wojcicki defended YouTube's handling of the incident.
Look, if we took down that content, there would be so much other content that we would need to take down. And we are not, we don't want to just be knee-jerk. We need to think about
it. And I called up Ina to talk more about what she had to say.
She started out with this apology and saying, I know a lot of people were hurt. But then the next words out of her mouth were, you know, we looked at it, we checked, and it didn't violate our policies, and we did the right thing. So it wasn't, from my perspective, an apology for their actions. And so I confronted her in the question and answer period, and I said, are you sorry people were offended, or are you apologizing for any specific action? And she hemmed and hawed a bit, and I think, you know, bottom line is she feels like Google actually followed its policies.
It feels like YouTube has a couple of options here. One is to block or remove content. Another is to demonetize content. How do those two play off against each other, and are there other possible solutions?
Sure, there's two, and I'd throw in a third. So those two are certainly two of the main options. So they can take a video down, and that's the strongest action, and that's really for when a video clearly crosses their lines of what their policies are. Demonetizing, you know, they have a tremendous amount of flexibility here. Basically, that means they won't serve ads and share revenue against it. And there's two reasons they might do this. One is to send a signal to the content creator that they don't approve of the content. But the other is, that's where they make their money, and advertisers don't want to be associated in general, even with controversial content most of the time, but certainly not with offensive content. So I think that's a practical step that they will take. The third, and this is probably the most fruitful area for growth, is in recommendations. So what are they pushing people towards? And I think people underestimate the power of that. I think I've heard 70% of YouTube views come from what's recommended, not from what people initially start on. So that's the area, I think, where all of the platforms, including and especially YouTube, have the most area to improve. Twitter's executives, who are also at Code, talked a fair amount about this. So even if they support free speech and support letting more content than some people would like live on the platform, they certainly don't have to amplify it.
And the other issue, it seems to be, that in trying to curtail things like neo-Nazi hate speech on YouTube and ban Holocaust deniers, the company has removed videos from history teachers talking about Adolf Hitler. And I think the same has happened with positive LGBTQ content, that it's going down because it's caught by some algorithm. So what is the challenge in separating what is acceptable from what isn't if you're trying to be a good police officer?
So those are definitely two different challenges and two important challenges for YouTube. The second one first is a newer one with their new policies where you're not allowed to post information that propagates the idea that one group is better than another. It is true, and they actually warned this would happen, that some people educating about the Holocaust are actually going to initially find themselves, I think they'll find themselves very quickly reinstated, or that's the hope. The second issue you get is a more challenging one for the industry, which is that people talking about LGBTQ issues tend to get flagged or banned as, you know, risky or adult content, even if they're just talking not sexually, just about identity. And the people who attack LGBTQ tend to get protected as free speech and just expressing an opinion. I brought this up with Twitter because Twitter has a real problem in this area where oftentimes the people who are being harassed, women, people of color, LGBTQ people, are the ones that find themselves getting banned for either defending themselves or pointing out how they're being harassed, and the harassers flourish. And I saw somebody put it really well last night, the idea that, you know, people talk about free speech all the time, but part of free speech is, I feel like I'll be free enough not to be harassed.
Ina Fried is the chief technology correspondent at Axios. Ina, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. I'm joined now by Jonathan Shiflett, one of our producers. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. What did you bring downstairs for us?
There is a surf film documentary coming out this weekend. It's called Self-Discovery for Social Survival.
It's a long title.
I had to bring my notes so I could remember what it was called.
What's it about?
Well, it's a collaborative film between surfers and musicians. where you have a few different sequences, one shot in Mexico, one shot in the Maldives, one shot in Iceland, and then musicians sort of take those sequences and interpret it. Someone who was involved with this project pretty heavily was a surf journalist, Jamie Brissick. We'll start with him in Surfrider in Malibu.
So we're sitting on the beach at Malibu First Point. And Malibu is hugely historical in the world of surfing. Design breakthroughs, great surfers, so much kind of happened right here on this beach. When I told my dad I wanted to be a professional surfer, I might as well have said, I want to follow the Grateful Dead around the country for the rest of my life. It was like not good news to him. Gone are the college years for my dear son, who I hope would get an education. And so when I first started writing about surfing in the 90s, I remember thinking, I'll write about surfing for a short while and then I got to get out of this world because it's so limited. What I failed to take into account is that surfing is a live organism. And as it has grown over the 25 years that I've been closely observing it, it sort of cross-pollinated with other cultures. As it kind of touches against fashion, music, visual art, etc., it brings people in who are influential in the culture. And so it wasn't like that when I was younger. I mean, surfers were kind of dropouts. Yeah, so Chris gave me the wonderful assignment to write the voiceover script for the film, Self-Discovery for Social Survival. And he sent over footage for me to kind of absorb. And then I also did research. And what was interesting with Iceland is that, you know, there are all these myths there that are unique to Iceland. A lot of them revolve around the sea, and there are sea creatures. And then Chris gave me kind of anecdotes from the trip and talked about arriving and going to a bar one night and meeting old fishermen. And so I kind of riffed from there.
I live in Reykjavik, he told us. But my home is out there on that cold, gray sea.
Jonas Mekas, the filmmaker, was the perfect person to read the voiceover because there was this strange kind of collision of suntanned kids tearing apart waves and then this older man's voice. It almost had this sense of looking back on one's life.
He said that we were all cousins, the surfers, the fishermen, the great explorers, the white whales, the giant squids.
Hello, my name is Conan Moccasin. Yeah, I'm from a place in New Zealand called Tiawonga, which is maybe 500 people. And I used to go surfing there when I was growing up. I got a little bit out here in Malibu. Stephanie's taken me out here since we've done the film.
Hi, my name's Stephanie Gilmore. And yeah, I'm a pro boogie boarder. No, I'm kidding. Wait. Hi, my name's Stephanie Gilmore, and I am Conan Mockinson's biggest fan. This kind of came about, I think, because Chris Gentil, who is the director of the film, he wanted to get me involved, and I'd never been to Iceland before, and I just heard about it, and I was like, this is just the coolest thing ever, to go on a surf trip to Iceland with a bunch of, you know, friends and musicians, just adventure around. That's so fun.
It's like, seems a little bit silly because it's so cold, but I was happy just to be there and watch these surfers. That was really exciting for me. You know, they just make it look so effortless.
I'm a huge fan of Conan and Andrew Van Wingarden as well. I don't know, when I heard they were coming on the trip, I was a little bit shy too because I wasn't sure, you know, how they were going to, well, I didn't really know how well they surfed, number one. I was like, are we going to be saving these people or are we going to be, like, are they going to be ripping and sort of showing us up or how does this work?
Most of the time I didn't go out because it was too vicious. I think they all have close call stories, yeah. Sharks, I like asking about sharks too. I'm scared of, like, most people have sharks.
Just the imagery blew my mind. Like, the fact that you could be surfing a perfect wave and behind you is a snow-capped mountain. It felt like, you know, Earth at the beginning of time.
Andrew Van Wingarden and I, we dictaphoned some of the music in Iceland, but then we did the majority when we got back to New York. We recorded most of it at his house.
never really talked about how the film was going to come out. I think we were just so present in the trip and getting to know each other. And that really is the coolest part about a surf trip, because when you share that feeling with friends, and then also after the surf and you come in and, you know, everyone's sitting around by a fire or talking about the surf session, that's really the best part about surf trips. And I think trying to capture that and try and put it into film is probably a pretty difficult thing to do.
Jonathan, it makes me feel like I'm out at the beach. That was really nice. Thanks.
Oh, good. That's what I hope for. You got it.
That's Jonathan Shiflett, one of the Frame's producers. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. Our last story today is about the movie The Last Black Man in San Francisco. It's basically a movie about two things. It's about friendship. It was actually made by two longtime friends, director Joe Talbot and actor Jimmy Fails. And it's also about loving a city and what happens to that love affair when you can no longer afford to live in the city that you call home. It's Jimmy Fails and Joe Talbot's first film. Here's Jimmy and then Joe talking about how they made it.
You know, we shot the concept trailer and we kind of wrote something together, and it mainly was just the family story about the house originally.
How'd y'all get this? It's Jimmy's. His grandpa built it. He was the first black man in San Francisco.
That's what they call him anyways.
Oh, shit. This that house? Hey, Jimmy used to talk about this spot all the time.
What did this house mean to you growing up? And what did you want to make sure that you captured about it in this movie?
Well, the house is sort of my lover in the film, I guess you could say. But for me, growing up, it represented like the only place where my whole family kind of was together. So when we lost the house, like my family's kind of dispersed across the country, like, and no one's really in contact with each other anymore. So it just represented like family and home for me, basically.
Your family lost your house. You were foreclosed on when you were six, is that right?
Yeah, about five or six, yeah.
We're talking with Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails about their movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So Joe, when you were going and talking to people at the get-go, they could be potential investors, they could be people that you wanted to hire. What was your short pitch for this film? How would you even boil this story down to like 15 or 20 seconds?
I'd say, don't you want to finance a movie between a high school dropout and someone who's never acted in a professional film before? Come on. No, I mean, it was hard. It was hard. You know, I think, like Jimmy said, we shot this very funky concept trailer where I was hanging out in my brother's car as he's driving, and I'm filming Jimmy skating back to the house that's sort of, you know, the film is centered on. And we did a much more elaborate version of that sort of in the beginning of the film. And I posted it on my Vimeo, which was hidden at the time. I, like every director, wanted to keep finessing it. It wasn't quite right. And my Vimeo, I didn't pay the annual fee, and so all my videos went public. So I was freaking out and was trying to get the money to hide them again when a local blogger wrote me and said, oh, you know, I really like this piece and I'd love to post it. And so I sort of reluctantly said, oh, sure. And then from there, it started to spread. And, you know, I think it just speaks to Jimmy's story. And we started to discover how unfortunately universal it was.
When you think about the city and the way it's depicted, Jimmy, your character says in the film, you can't hate San Francisco unless you love it. Do I have that line right?
Yes, you do.
What does that mean to both of you? And I'll start with you, Jimmy, about the city, because the way you shoot in the film is both beautiful and gritty. It is both, you know, your best friend and your worst betrayer.
I mean, for me, it's just very simple in the line. It's like you I don't think you are able to hate something unless you love it, really. You know, it's like San Francisco has been such an integral part of me as an artist and as a person. So, you know, I have no choice but to love it in that way. But then it's also like, you know, when it's changing rapidly and it doesn't feel the same way as when you were growing up, then, you know, it you do kind of have a little, I wouldn't say hate, but, you know, you start to, you know, love it a little less because it doesn't feel like it did.
What about you, Joe?
Yeah, I think, you know, for all its beauty, the people are what make San Francisco what it is. And as more and more of those people that we grew up with that made the city great can't afford to stay there. Many of whom have fought like hell to stay there. You know, that becomes the thing. It's like every conversation you hear in San Francisco these days is about, you know, why you're justifying staying there when it's so hard just to get by. People work multiple jobs because they, you know, there is something about the city that we love. But as more and more of those people that make the city great are no longer there, you do start to really question, well, then, you know, what is San Francisco?
Joe and Jimmy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Last Black Man in San Francisco is in theaters now, and that's The Frame Weekend for this week. This program is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn saying goodbye from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Be sure to join us on Monday for the weekday edition of The Frame.